Today is September 15th. It's Thursday morning, 2011. We're beginning our study of Jewish thought again this year for the seventh straight year with a group of people that more or less has remained constant, which is pretty gratifying. We're studying this year for the second year Providence and Theodicy. Last year we learned this subject through the lenses of the Bible, the Tanakh. And this year we're going to look at the words of Chazal, the rabbis, the sages, and this also the Rishonim, the authorities of the Middle Ages, including the Ralbag and the Rambam, among others. And I think that we'll also get to thinkers of the modern era. I'm not sure we'll get to that, but I think we'll get to it at the end of the year, thinkers of the modern era. So now, here we go. First class, the matter of theodicy and providence in Chazal. When I say Chazal, the rabbis of the Mishnah and the Tosefta and the Talmud and all the Midrashim, whether it's Midrash Agadah, the Midrashim that present stories, or Midrash Halakha, the Midrashim that present law. We're talking about a period of time that extends until about the year 700, perhaps even 800 of the Common Era. And when it begins is hard to say. The first recorded material we have from Chazal is from about 100 years before the Common Era. But of course, we're talking about traditions that predate even that. So we're talking about a period of at least 1,000 years. 1,000 years. And again, the main sources are the Talmudim and the Midrashim and the Tosefta and the Mishnah, as we're about to see. Now, there's so much material in Chazal, and Chazal, of course, is not one person, it's not 10 people, it's hundreds of rabbis over all these centuries that we talked about, so we're not going to find one monolithic approach. Of course, this is Judaism, and even more than that, we're talking about a long period of time with many different thinkers in different lands.
The Tanaim and the Amoraim.
This includes the Tanaim and the Amoraim, and even what they call the Savoraim, which is the generation or two or three after the Amoraim, after the rabbis of the Talmud, after the year 500, 600, even 700. Now, how am I going to organize all this material? And I've been thinking perhaps I won't organize, I'll just present it haphazardly. No, but there has to be some organizing principle. I'm going to do my best to organize it. What I decided to do to begin with is to take that material in Chazal on the subject of providence and theodicy that deals directly and specifically with the book of Job, and to begin there. Because that's a segue with last year. Last year we ended our study
with Job.
So let's begin now in Chazal with the Midrashim and the statements and the halachot that directly relate on the subject of providence and theodicy to the book of Job. So here we go. The first source is from Midrash Breishit Rabbah. And I'll just say something I've said in the past. What is Midrash Breishit Rabbah? So we have a book that's called Midrash Rabbah. It's a Midrash of Agadah, not Halakha. Agadah doesn't deal with law, with exegesis of law. Doesn't tell us what to do. It's stories and opinions and tales that relates to 10 different books of the Bible. Midrash Rabbah has 10 different sections. 5 sections that relate to the Torah, right? Breishit, Shmot, Vayikra, Bamidbar, Dvarim, the 5 books of the Torah, and the 5 Megillot. At the Megillot, the scrolls, we're talking about Esther, we're talking about Ruth, we're talking about Ecclesiastes, we're talking about the Song of Songs, and we're talking about
Proverbs. Lamentations.
Right? These are the 5 scrolls that are read in synagogue at different times. That's probably why there's a lot of midrashic material on them, because they're not just there in the Bible, actually read in synagogue, and most people know them and have heard of them. So Midrash Rabbah has 10 sections, and it's important to know that these 10 sections were not written at the same period by the same editors and authors. Rather, they're 10 separate, different books with different approaches to Midrash, and different worldviews from different periods, but they were brought together, they were stitched together, because they all relate to books that are then read in the synagogue. They're part of the cycle of the Jewish year. So we're reading now Midrash Breishit Rabbah, Midrash Rabbah on the book of Breishit, on the book of Genesis. And we're going to read just the first seven or eight words to begin with. Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish said, and Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish is in other places known as Reish Lakish. He was a highway robber before he became a rabbi. He's a real, authentic, what
Baal
we call
Shuvah.
Baal Shuvah, right? He returned in repentance. Although,
did he pay for his sin first?
I don't know if he paid for his sins, but the truth is that one might say he's not a true Baal Shuvah because his ahava for Torah, his love for Torah, you can say at the beginning, was tluya b'davar. It was dependent on something. He was, Rabbi Yochanan said to him, if you cease being a highway robber and start learning Torah, I'll give you my daughter in marriage.
Oh. But isn't this?
And Rabbi Yochanan was a very, 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 very handsome man, the Gemara says. We can assume that his daughter was a very beautiful girl, and Reish Lakish decided to take the girl and give up highway robbery. And he became a great, great rabbi.
But isn't there something that you have to return something that's not yours that you've taken?
You're right, that one who's stolen has to return. So I can't tell you exactly what Reish Lakish did, and I don't know. So Reish Lakish said the following, and I'm calling him Reish Lakish, that's what we usually call him. Here he's called Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish. Job never existed at all. Lo haya velo nivra. Never was and was never created. There's no man as Job. Rather, as other rabbis who begin in the same fashion say, rather, ela mashal haya. The book is a parable. The book of Job is a parable. There was no man ever called Job who lived. It was a parable. It's not historically true. So we have to ask ourselves the following question. Why would Reish Lakish make this claim that the story didn't take place? It's not historically true. It's just a mashal. Why would he say that? What might be his purpose? What does he gain from this theologically?
You think to make people look beyond just the story itself to what its true meaning is?
Okay, to look beyond the story itself to the true meaning. And when one looks beyond, so then what happens to the story?
The point is, at the end of the story, you never know why God punished, when God went through this whole thing with Job. But
it's not clear.
Reish Lakish's reason is to help people understand that God does not act capriciously.
Ah, that's very good. That's very good. Let me continue what Mo said by pointing out that this isn't the only place in the literature of Chazal that one or another rabbi says that something really wasn't, never took place. And I'll give an example from last week's Torah portion. Right? Last week's Torah portion, not this week, but last week, that we read on Shabbat 6 days ago. We have there at the very beginning of the parsha,
the one who captured the battle, who was going to become a...
Right, the first story there, the first law, is the woman captured in battle. The second story is the man who has two wives, one loved. And the third story is Ben Sorer Umore, the rebellious
son.
The disobedient and wayward son. And concerning that parsha, that matter, in which it says that this wayward son should be stoned, right? Some of the rabbis say in Tractate Sanhedrin, the 8th chapter, they say, Lo haya velo nivra. It never was, never will be. It's written just in order to learn it and benefit from it. Benefit from it, in other words, so parents will know how serious it is to keep their kids in line, and kids will know if you don't behave, that is what might happen. But we never really, really would carry out the law. Well, why would the rabbi say such a thing? Because the law seems extremely harsh, immoral, doesn't fit into any legal framework we know, because the Torah never says that for disobedience you are to be stoned. I mean, you're supposed to honor your parents. And the Ben Sorer Moreh, the rebellious son, it says he's a glutton and a drunkard, but the Torah never says that for such things, for gluttony, eating too much, drinking too much, you should be stoned. So why is he stoned? So the rabbi said, some of the rabbis said, not all of them, some of them said, he's really not stoned. We never would do such a thing, but it's written in order to keep the kids in line. And then, in that same chapter, in Tractate Sanhedrin, the rabbis also say, some rabbis say, right? Not all. There's a machlok, there's an argument. There's another matter in the book of Deuteronomy that's only written for the educational benefit, for the pedagogical benefit, but it's not meant actually to be carried out. And that is the... Do you know, Chip?
It's not the trial of our deal. That's Numbers, I guess.
That's the Numbers, right.
Yeah.
It's the Ir HaNidachat. The Ir HaNidachat is the city that has wholly gone over to idolatry, a Jewish city in which everyone there has become idolaters, and the law says the city should be burnt with everyone in it. The whole city should be completely destroyed. And there also, some rabbis say, Lo Hayav Lo Nivra. It was never meant to be. We'll find a way not to actually execute this law. It's just written to keep people in line. Let them know. Now, in those two cases of the idolatrous city and the rebellious son, clearly the reason why some rabbis claim this wasn't meant to be carried out in actuality is because of the moral issue. Just can't be. What's written there just can't be. Doesn't morally jive with what we know and what we believe to be true. And then Mo is saying it might be the same thing when Reish Lakish says that Job never exists at all. Because Reish Lakish is saying what's written in the book, it can't be. It couldn't be that a person who's righteous and upright and never sinned in a fear of God, that he would suffer so badly, that just can't be. And the book is a mashal, it's a parable. And the minute you say that something is a parable, it means that part of it is true in the sense it's meant to teach a lesson, and the rest of it is background, right? If I tell you the parable of the boy who cried wolf, and I say that once upon a time in Siberia, there was a boy that cried wolf according to the parable, and then someone will raise their hand, wait a second, there are no wolves in Siberia. That doesn't matter. That's not the point. So the same thing in the book of Job. It's a parable. It has a message. Now, I don't know what the message is yet, but if you say it's a parable, then necessarily, almost necessarily, not all of the details are true. They're just there to make a point. They're background to get to the point. So perhaps Reish Lakish is saying that the book has a point. A lot of stuff there is just for the background. And if you ask me about the terrible things that happened to Job, no, man, it didn't really happen. That's just the background to make the point. So it might be, I'm finally going to stop speaking, it might be that Reish Lakish is bothered, terribly bothered, by the philosophical, moral issues that have bothered us for the past year. Why do bad things happen to good people? And the book doesn't seem to give a very good answer to that, right? So it might be that Reish Lakish is saying, the book's not talking about that question. It's not talking about why the bad things happening to good people. And the fact that Job was a good guy and bad things happened to him, that's not the point. That's just a setup for something else. So it could be that Reish Lakish is dealing with the central issue of theodicy by saying it just can't be, it never was, and bad things like that just do not happen to good people. They don't. Somebody wants to speak for the past
Rabbi
5 minutes.
Rabbi Hirsch of the Natura Carta, 1981, took it seriously. We were digging in Ir David where your son leads groups, I think, and they came every day at noon with rocks and stones to injure us. They had to be fought off with police on horses and the fire department with hoses.
But what's the point?
The point is it's taken seriously by some sects today.
Obviously, stoning. Some people take
by
the...
By stoning.
I see. Yes, we're talking about... certain opinions
and
here. Not everyone.
Today.
Not everyone.
Also, they throw stones.
Okay.
In other words, there's Jewish terrorists that believe in the extreme.
They're the only people who've ever stoned me, not the Arabs.
If you want to talk about that, come to the showing of the movie Brothers.
Yes.
on September 25th.
The 25th?
Yeah, I think it's the 25th.
Which is also the same day as the Kiba dinner.
Right, but you can go to both. You can come to the dinner and then come to the movie. The dinner is early and the movie is late, but now we're going back to Chip.
If you take it that it is a mashal, and that parts, what's to prevent looking at the rest of the biblical books in that same way?
It's a good question. It's a good question, and I don't have a good answer. And there was at least one thinker in the Middle Ages, by the name of Levi ben Levi, who took Abraham and Sarah as a mashal, and he was excommunicated.
I bet so.
And Rabbi, this is in Midrash Bereshit, Rabbi.
Yes, it is.
But Book of Job is not one of the books you said that Mishnah Rabbah.
You're right. But when a Midrash, I didn't bring here the context of this Midrash, and it's obviously based on some verse in the Book of Genesis that I didn't bring, and I don't remember what it is. Okay. But in the context of Midrashing the verse, they come to this other subject by way of association. Let's read on. This view of Reish Lakish is self-contradictory, challenges the editor. For elsewhere he said, in the name of Bar Kappara, he flourished in the days of Abraham, while here he maintains thus. So we have a problem, because in one place we quote Reish Lakish as saying that Job didn't exist, it was only a mashal, it was only a parable. Another place, we have a quote from Reish Lakish in the name of another rabbi, Bar Kappara, saying that actually we know that he was a real person, Job, and he lived in the time of Abraham. So we have a contradiction. What are we going to do? We will have to find an artificial, let's say synthetic way, to make these two opinions non-contradictory. And the Midrash finds a way to do that. He means, however, that he was never exposed to the suffering ascribed to him. In other words, we're compromising. Job existed, there was such a person, but the things that the book says about him didn't take place. Okay? So it's a mashal written about a person that really did exist, but it's just a mashal. So power and purpose is the same thing. The book is a mashal, the person, there was such a person, but the story about him is a mashal. Fine. Why then were they ascribed to him? So why, if it's a mashal, what's the point of the mashal? Why did we say these things about Job, the real man, if they didn't really happen? Because had they come upon him, he would have been able to withstand them. In other words, we're being told actually the point of the mashal. We should understand that the book of Job is a story of righteousness. It was written to show us how righteous, how great, how upstanding a man can be. That this man, Job, was such a great tzaddik that even had all these things happen, they didn't, but even had all these things happened to him, he would still have maintained his righteousness. So just wait a second. So if we thought that the book of Job was a book about theodicy, it's not. It's not about theodicy. That's not the point of the book. And if we thought the book is asking the question, why do bad things happen to good people, the book is not concerned with that question. We read it incorrectly. All that stuff that seemed to be a theodicy is just background. The real point of the book is to show us how great a human being can be.
Or how miserable God can be.
No, that's not the point.
Yes,
no,
to me it is.
That's not the... But wait a second. We have to say to Stephanie what we've said to Stephanie many times in the past. We're going to say the same thing, right? At this point, we're not learning the book of Job.
Yes.
We don't care what we think the book of Job says. We're learning what one particular rabbi in one particular midrash has to say about the book of Job. And that reveals to us, if you want to be radical about it, nothing about the book of Job, but everything about that particular rabbi's approach. And that particular rabbi's approach is one of the many approaches in the Jewish tradition in the time of Chazal.
No,
wait a second.
Yeah, sorry. Go ahead.
Then.
If this is a fact, that it was more about him being righteous, then why put the blame on God?
It's just background. I don't have to answer that question because the point is, what does Reish Lakish think according to the Midrash?
Sure.
How he got there, okay, we have a different... I have difficulties with, of course I do. as far as, but that's not the point.
Believing that God could inflict such punishment on an innocent person,
right.
He comes up with this idea.
Right.
But the bottom line is, if that is true, then why would this be included in our book?
It's included, says Rish Lakish, to show you as a model to emulate how great a human being can be.
But it also talks about how mean God can
that's
be.
Right.
No, but that's just, again, that's just the background. That's not important. It's just a literary flourish.
But you could have written a story that would have shown how righteous someone is without banging God around.
You're right. So you have a kushya, you have a difficulty against Reish Lakish. You say, Reish Lakish, I want to argue with you. Your explanation of the book, it doesn't fit.
Yeah, I don't think it does.
So it doesn't fit, but we know at least what Reish Lakish believes now.
Yeah, I don't.
Reish Lakish believes that God would never do such things. Okay? And such things don't happen. Which means the following. Let me just say one more thing now. That means that Reish. The book seems to say that Job was completely righteous and nevertheless bad things, terrible things, happened to him. Says Reish Lakish, can't be. Such things will not happen in this world. Why won't they happen? Because Reish Lakish probably believes that there's no suffering without sin. And if the book says that Job didn't sin and he suffered, no, that's just the background. The point is that he managed to come through all that suffering with flying colors. But what we reveal here in the depths of the thinking of Reish Lakish is a deep, deep denial of a reality in which there is suffering without sin. The righteous do not suffer, says Reish Lakish. It never happens. And if you see someone suffering, you can be certain that there must be some sin there in the background.
Two fast things. One is that God does, according to the book of Job, the thing that God does is he stands aside. God is not the one that punishes, but it's... And I see YT here agrees with me, whoever YT is. Verse 5. The note.
Yeah, yeah. Who? I'm trying to think. Who is that? Yerushalmi
Talmud? No, V doesn't apply.
Yes, I don't know.
V.
That's the Sensino translation notes.
Okay, but the other thing...
It's complicit.
It's getting, back, getting back to the previous question. The issue still is, why is a book included in the canon?
So we answer it, to show a story of great, great righteousness.
But the problem then is, you need somebody of Reish Lakish's stature to help us understand that point, you know, if we agree with,
yeah.
Assuming that we agree with Reish Lakish.
Well, I guess one comment is, it seems like it's saying, you know, just like I agree, you know, God isn't the one inflicting the suffering, but I guess he allows free will of people, Satan, whatever, to do whatever, you know, they have this freedom to do whatever they can. And so how do you explain, you know, good things happened, bad things happened to good people that have been happening for over, you know, thousands and thousands of years, but why to good people? And it's, I don't know, maybe it's the free will that God has put into the world.
I think that's for other sources, but here, Reish Lakish seems to say no. Bad things don't happen to totally good people. They don't. Because you always can find some sin, and if the book says that Job was totally righteous and he suffered, that's just a literary flourish. It's not the point.
He sounded like him. How would he rationalize martyrdom? You know, a rabbi, a very righteous man.
As we will see next week or the week after, you can always find some sin, even in the most righteous. And God, midakdek im chasidav kechut asara, God is exacting with his pious to a hair's breadth. In other words, the better you are, the higher the standard is. So you could have a person who's been righteous his whole life. He made one mistake when he was 49 and a half years old. He didn't open the door for a ani, for an indigenous person who was asking for bread, and he is martyred for that. You can always find something. Am I telling you my opinion? No. That's probably what Reish Lakish holds.
They scrub you as carefully as political candidates are today.
Yeah. Okay. Now let's see another source. From the Babylonian Talmud, Tractate Sota, page 11a. And it's on the verse from the book of Exodus, come, let us deal wisely with him. And that is Paro talking, as it were, to his people when he sees the Israelites have grown numerous and he's afraid they'll become a fifth column and take over the country. So he says, come, let us deal wisely with them, with the Israelites. But the translation used the word him. Rabbi Chiya bar Abba said in the name of Rabbi Simai. There were three in that plan. In other words, when Paro made a plan to enslave the Jewish people, he had three advisors who were involved with him. And who are they? Bilam, Job, and Jethro. Right? We know Bilam from the book of Numbers, and we know Jethro from the book of Exodus, that's Yitro, who became the father-in-law of Moshe, and Job. Job, according to this Midrash and others, was one of the advisors of Paro. He was in the cabinet, the Egyptian cabinet. Says the Midrash, Bilam, who devised it, was slain. As Bilam was the genius who devised the plan to enslave the Jewish people. So he was punished for that. He was slain. And later on in the book of Bamidbar, in the book of Numbers, it says that the Israelites killed Bilam. Job, who silently acquiesced, was afflicted with suffering. We'll come back to that. Yitro, who fled, in other words, Yitro didn't agree with the plan. It was accepted by a 3-1 majority, right? Okay, so Job didn't vote. Yitro objected, but Paro and Bilam accepted the plan. So Yitro, who fled, merited that his descendants should sit in the chamber of hewn stones, which means that's the chamber in the temple where the Sanhedrin sat. What it means is that eventually Yitro converted, his children were Jewish, and they became great scholars, and then it brings some verses as if to prove that he converted and his children, great-grandchildren, great-great-great-grandchildren became scholars and interpreters and decisors of Jewish law. Okay, so let's go back now to what concerns us, which is Job. And the Midrash says, Job, who silently acquiesced, was afflicted with suffering. So we can imagine that there's this council here of four, and Bilam is gung-ho to get the Jews, and Paro loves the plan, and Job and Yitro, they object, but they don't know exactly how to deal with the situation. So Yitro really stands up what he believes in, and he flees. But Job is a righteous man, right? He's a great man. He doesn't agree with what Paro is about to do to the Jewish people, but he doesn't have the backbone, doesn't have the spine to object, so he just stays silent. He doesn't agree, he doesn't disagree. And the claim of the Midrash is that for that little act of not objecting, and he didn't vote for the plan, he just didn't vote against it, for that little act of staying silent, for that non-act, he was afflicted with suffering. So, that's what it says. Now, the question is, so what's the point? Why does the Midrash say what it says? What's the point about Job?
You have to speak out against evil things, not just sit there quietly. Because to sit quietly is to agree with it, to approve it.
It's a sin of omission.
Absolutely, right? Sin of omission. Yeah. And now, as far as understanding the book of Job, what's the point of the Midrash? That point is correct, what you said. But as far as exegesis of the book of Job,
he'd been punished for that.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. In other words, the question is, why do the righteous suffer? The answer is, he wasn't righteous. Oh, the book says he was righteous. Yes, he was righteous, but he had one little sin, not of commission, a sin of omission. But for a man as great as he, even a sin like that is worthy of being punished with a great amount of suffering. So again, if you ask the question, why do bad things happen to good people? Says this Midrash, they don't.
Well, the point is, it's not a sin of I think sin of omission is too kind a word, because by his silence, he allowed terrible things to happen.
Kind of like God in the book of Job.
Well, you know,
that's very good. Right. That's very good. Dorothy.
At the very beginning of the book of Job, God and Satan have a conversation, and the whole basis is to find, quote, an innocent man to see whether he would break down under adverse situation. So both God and Satan admit at the beginning of the book of Job that Job is innocent.
Right.
All of this is just somebody trying to come up with some idea to prove their point, but it is denied in the book.
Good point.
That he has
right. Good point. Dorothy is saying, like she said 5 minutes ago, she's saying it again on the next Midrash, right? She said in the first Midrash, now in the second one, she's saying very fine and dandy, but this contradicts the pshat of the book of Job. Good. You're right. In other words, these two Midrashim, first Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish and now Rabbi Chiya bar Abba, they are struggling mightily against the book of Job. I wouldn't even say they're struggling with it. They're struggling against it. Right? Because it seems to say something that they says can't be. It seems to say that the innocent suffer. But they say no, the innocent do not suffer. And they find an exegetical way, and you say it's going behind the back like this, and you're probably right. Right? They're denying the pshat of the book. And that just shows us how seriously they're taking this and how mightily they're struggling.
So abstinence does not make the heart grow fonder. To abstain.
Jay.
Well, I think that Dorothy's point is absolutely spot on, but despite that, and we've talked about this before, that I don't want to dwell on it, but the thing that refutes this concept, I think, is the fact that there are truly innocent people that have not sinned.
Mm-hmm.
Take, for example, children. Small children. I mean, you could go down to a child within days, weeks, months, or whatever, and it would be difficult to, I think, envision any circumstances where there was sin in that circumstance. You could probably think of other things. So wouldn't that on its face value kind of invalidate this argument?
I hear what you're saying. Right? And you'd have to ask Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish and Rabbi Chiya bar Abba what they say about that.
This is the weaker of the two points. It's less, the second one is easier to say is wrong than the first one.
Wrong is an interpretation of the book of Job.
Right. In other words, you could build a case against this Midrash a whole lot easier.
Yeah, look, we hear
they're
what you're saying, and you have a good point. You have a good point.
But
let's just remember.
The second one is totally.
But I just want us to understand that it's not that Rabbi Chiya bar Abba never heard what Dorothy is saying, right? I'm sure there have been arguments between Rabbi Chiya bar Abba and other sages, with the other sages saying what Dorothy said, and Rabbi Chiya bar Abba. That's the reason why he chooses a sin of omission and not a sin of commission. Because he's going to claim it, the book says he was perfectly righteous. And I agree. He didn't have any sins of commission. But he did have a sin of omission. For him, that's enough to blemish his record. I hear you, Dorothy. I hear. But again, one more thing. And then, Mo, all these things are important to say. Absolutely. But in the end, the point is, what is the range of opinions among our rabbis? And it's less important how they got to those opinions. Right? We now understand that there are two important rabbis, Rabbi Chiya bar Abba and Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish, who really seem to hold that there is no suffering without some sin.
Well, I think we're caught in another kind of problem. Let's assume for a minute that I was a devout Orthodox Jew, which would be quite an assumption. But there's three sets of books in the canon, in the Tanakh. First four, up through Bamidbar, are God's books, right? Then we've got Moses' book, which is Deuteronomy. Then the rest of the books are really the products of man. If I wanted to argue about the truth, or what does Stephen Colbert call it, the truthiness of a book, I'd go after the book of Jonah. Was there really a whale that swallowed a man? Is there a whale that, maybe there's a whale that big, but the digestive juices would kill him in time, pretty quickly. So this is I can accept the fact, even as a devout person, or I would be able to, as a devout person, to accept the book of Job as a parable.
Yes, yes.
That's not outside of deep devout Judaism.
You're right. It's right in the Talmud.
Yeah.
It's right in the Talmud.
No question. These guys kept kosher and everything else.
Yeah. Well, they probably didn't keep kosher as well as we do.
They do.
They didn't have all the laws of the last right. 50 years to be
used. Right. Okay, we're going on to another Midrash at the bottom of the page. Babylonian Talmud, Tractate Kiddushin, page 40b. Rabbi Elazar ben Rabbi Tzadok said, "To what are the righteous compared in this world? To a tree standing holy in a place of cleanness." At the bottom of the page, last two lines. But its bough overhangs to a place of uncleanliness. When the bough is lopped off, it stands entirely in a place of cleanliness. Thus the Holy One, blessed be He, brings suffering upon the righteous in this world in order that they may inherit the future world, the world to come. As it is said, quote, "And though thy beginning is small, yet thy latter end shall greatly increase." And to what are the wicked compared in this world? To a tree standing holy in a place of uncleanness. But a branch thereof overhangs a place of cleanness. When the bough is lopped off, it stands entirely in a place of uncleanness. Thus the Holy One, blessed be He, makes them prosper, the wicked, in this world, in order to destroy and consign them to the nethermost rung. For it is said, there is a way which seemeth right unto man, but at the end thereof are the ways of death. So you have these two trees. Let's begin with the tree that is in a place of uncleanness, but one of its branches is overhanging a place of cleanness. So you get rid of that one branch, and then you see what the tree really is. It's just a tree of uncleanness. And that's the verse they bring at the end from the book of Proverbs. There's a way which seemeth right unto man. That's an evil person who looks good, but at the end thereof are ways of death. But the truth is, he's going to just get in the end death, which means being cut off from the next world. But how do you cut him off from the next world completely? By lopping off that branch that extends into the place of cleanness, which means that whatever good he does in this world, you get rid of it in this world, you give it its due, so that in the next world, God can completely and utterly wipe him out, punish him, exterminate him, whatever. And the same thing is true for the righteous. The righteous, they have some sins. But you don't want those sins to stand in the next world. You don't want them to prevent him from getting the full measure of reward in the next world. So he's punished for those sins in this world so that they're wiped clean from the slate. So the next world he could be completely and absolutely rewarded completely. Now, that's an... Yes?
That's a one-sided... I mean, I can understand the logic of saying, okay, I need to have the righteous man suffer a little bit in this world so that he will be perfect in the world to come. But to say that I'm going to take somebody who is a bad person and make him perfectly bad so that I can really get him in the world to come, kind of really, it kind of goes against the grain somehow.
Well, let me draw it like this. This is the line of life. The line of life. And you would think that I mean to say that this is when a person is born, and this is when a person dies. But no. The truth is really that this is where a person is born, and this is where a person dies. And the quote-unquote majority of his life is really after his death.
It's just a drop in the bucket for this world.
It's just a drop in the bucket in this world. So if you have a person who is righteous, you want to give him full reward in the time that really counts. But he has a few sins, and you want to wipe them clean from the slate, so you punish them. So you'll punish him just this amount of time, just 70 years, that's all. It's nothing in the grand scheme of things. I think that's what this approach says.
I can understand that. It's the other part that bothers me. That I'm going to take someone that's bad, and I'm going to make him perfectly bad.
In other words, what we do is punish him just a little bit.
No.
I'm sorry. I'm going to punish him.
Reward him.
Right, I'm going to reward him just a little bit for his what he deserves to be rewarded for. I'll reward him just for 50 years, for 60 years. It's perfectly fair. He deserves a little bit of reward. 1% reward. I'll give him 1% reward, but that 1% reward is his whole life. Because that's a very small amount of the true picture. Claims this approach. Again, no one's claiming this is the only way of looking at these great questions. Now, this is a very important theory that appears in Jewish writings. But remember, we said that today we're studying literature of Chazal on the book of Job. So why did I bring this here? It doesn't mention the book of Job, but it does. Because the verse that it brings in the third and fourth line from the top of the page, we just read, as it is said, and though thy beginning is small, yet thy latter end shall greatly increase. That's from, look at footnote 14, that's from Job chapter 8, verse 7. And if I open up to the book of Job, to chapter 8, verse 7, I see this is Bildad the Shuhite talking to Job. And Bildad the Shuhite said to Job as follows, from the beginning of chapter 8, how long will you speak such things?
It's 1668 in the brown.
And in the green it's 1348. How long will you speak such things? Your utterances are a mighty wind. Will God pervert the right? Will the Almighty pervert justice? If your sons sin against him, he dispatched them for their transgression. But if you seek God and supplicate the Almighty, if you are blameless and upright, he will protect you and grant well-being to your righteous home. Though your beginning be small, in the end you will grow very great. And it's as if Bildad the Shuhite is saying to Job that you're blameless and upright, and God will grant you well-being in your righteous home, which is the next world. Your beginning is small. In other words, here in this world, you only have a small reward and your suffering. In the end, you will grow very great. In the end, you will be rewarded for your righteousness. So really, what we're doing here is we're interpreting the book of Job according to the rabbi's interpretation of the statement of Bildad, that really all of Job's suffering was just a drop in the bucket, and it was the suffering that a righteous man gets for the little bit of evil that he committed in this world. It's complete justice. There's no injustice here. If you ask why do the righteous suffer, they don't. only those who sin suffer. And someone who's 95% righteous and 5% guilty, so he suffers 5%. That 5% looks like a long time. But in the grand sweep of things, it's nothing.
And there's nobody who doesn't sin.
And there's no one who does. Ain tzaddik baretz asher lo yichatah. There's no man on earth, there's no tzaddik on earth that doesn't sin just a little bit.
So you're saying that in, let's see, in the third or fourth or fifth century, there was already a beginning of the idea of an afterlife.
Rabbi Elazar, the son of Rabbi Tzadok,
yeah. We
are...
That goes back.
We're in a, still in the end of the period of the Tanaim.
Yeah, so...
We're in the second century of the Common Era.
Already, that idea begins to emerge.
It's already found in the Mishnah before.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
In the Book of Maccabees, it even says that there's a reference to a fiend's wife.
Right, in the...
Is it first Maccabees or second?
I think I remember it in the third or the fourth. I think that you're right. So here we have a third source that says, vis-a-vis the Book of Job, that if you think it's a story of the righteous suffering unjustly, it's not. It's not that. There's no such thing as a righteous man suffering unjustly. If there's suffering, then there must be sin. And even Job sinned. In one case we saw his sin was a sin of omission. Here we don't see, we're not told what the sin is, but the reference that's made in this passage from the Talmud to Job seems to indicate that he was suffering for his sins.
Oh,
that's going to be a midrash. We'll see another 15 minutes.
It's Sodom and Amorah.
We're going to see that. But here it seems to be his sins. Absolutely his sins.
So, last semester or whatever, we already got to the point when it's 10 generations will suffer for the sin of a father.
Okay, but here it's him himself.
But here it's just him.
Here it's him himself.
Yeah.
I think people who propose this rationalize through a baby is born, it's never had a chance to do anything, and it gets caught in a terrible fire.
Okay, that's what Jay asked.
Right. But how do they rationalize that particular thing? I mean, that little life didn't even have a chance to sin, and yet it was killed in a fire. How do these people rationalize that?
I don't know. It could be that you have to bring it to it. Another theory. One theory can't cover all the cases. Perhaps there's another theory that will cover those cases. And indeed, we'll get to other theories that could complement these. Okay. Here's another source about this world and the next world, in the same vein, but from the other side of the coin. Babylonian Talmud, Tractate Baba Batra, page 15b. An objection was brought from a Braita. Now we know that a Braita is a source from the period of the Mishnah that is not part of the Mishnah, source from before the year 200 of the Common Era. And the fact that this Braita we're about to read is brought in the context of this passage, an objection to something is irrelevant for us. We're not seeing the context. What is an objection to? We're just seeing the Braita. So the Braita says as follows. There was a certain pious man among the heathen named Job. Where do you see this Braita holds that Job was not Jewish?
Heathen, yeah.
Right? Who came into this world only to receive here his reward. I'm not exactly sure what that means.
He was born to be...
He was born to be rewarded.
Made miserable.
No, it means...
That's how I look at it.
No, it means that he was...
Born to receive a reward.
Oh, perhaps it does mean...
That his reward was misery. If you can believe
again,
maybe they didn't believe the heathens had a place in the world.
No, he lived pretty well
until then, but that negates.
But let's read on, okay? Because the important point comes later. And when the Holy One, blessed be He, brought chastisements upon him, suffering, he began to curse and blaspheme. So the Holy One, blessed be He, doubled his reward in this world, so as to expel him from the world to come.
That's okay.
So now let's understand what it says as far as we can understand. First of all, it admits that he was a pious man. Number two, he was a heathen, which means he has a strike against him in this context. And it says that he began to curse and blaspheme. In other words, the author of this source understands the speeches and reactions of Job in the body of the book to be extremely negative. It's not like you could have read it that Job was actually within his rights to complain. No, that complaining is sinful and it's held against him. It's in the category of cursing and blasphemy. And it deserves punishment. And then this Midrash says, and I'm going to say this kind of tongue in cheek, that Job was punished for his sins by having his reward doubled. So what does it mean? It means, has this man, who is a pious man, and God seems to like him, and then he sins. And what does God do in response to his sin? He rewards him double. Counterintuitive, right? But that's what it says. God rewards him double for sinning, so as to expel him from the world to come. So according to this approach, the point of the book of Job is not so much the suffering, it's rather the reward at the end. Remember, Job got everything doubled at the end? He got everything that he lost returned to him double. He had more children and he had more money and he lived. I don't know if that says that, or remember? Right? And the point is, that was God, quote unquote, punishing him. God rewarded him by punishing him because God wanted to, now that God saw how bad he was, give him full punishment for that bad. And the only way to do it, give him full punishment for the bad, was to reward him for any good he might have done, so that when he gets to the next world, he could completely and absolutely be eradicated and exterminated. So the theory here is the same theory as the previous one. In other words, the main reward and punishment is the next world. Whatever happens in this world is just for the minority of a person's deeds. Whether it's that he was a sinner, and therefore his reward in this world for the good he did, or he's a righteous person, so he's punished in this world for the wrong he did, but the real stuff is the next world. The difference between the two sources is the evaluation of Job, which is really secondary to our subject. In this source we're seeing now, Job is a sinner. So he's reward in this world. In the previous Midrash, he's righteous, so he's punished in this world. But the point is, what you see is exactly the opposite of what you get. When you see someone suffering, you can know that God's rewarding him. When you see someone with great wealth, you can know God is punishing him. So that it's exactly counterintuitive to what you experience.
Therefore, if you see someone suffering on the street, you should not help them because God is punishing or is rewarding them, or punishing them, or whatever it is.
So He can reward them.
Well, yeah, so He can reward them. I mean, why would I interfere with what God's doing to this poor man?
If
believe it or not, we actually have opinions that say something very close to that. We have Midrashim in which pious people are unwilling to accept gifts from God in this world because they're afraid it will take away from their reward in the next world.
You explain the suffering to the Jewish people.
In other words, we don't do that towards other people, but towards ourselves, we do have such a thing. To refuse enjoyment in this world, fearful that it will take away from the reward in the next world.
Flagellation.
That's
I didn't say that, but I said, you're talking about commission, I'm talking about omission.
Yeah, okay.
If you extend it from the individual to the collective, could you look at the sufferings of the Jewish people as the short term, but the long term with the Jewish people in the next world, maybe even in the days of the Messiah, is going to be wonderful. It's going to be.
The answer is yes, you can. Yes, you can.
I don't know. I like Mark Twain, who said he'd rather be in hell with the interesting people.
So, we've seen here four separate midrashim that all seem to agree that we should not take the book of Job at face value.
Or at all.
And indeed, the totally righteous do not suffer. And how to parse the matter. So we've seen three different approaches in our four sources. The first approach says the book is just a mashal, and it's only literary flourish when it talks about the righteous man suffering, because he really didn't. And the second approach we saw said that he sinned, Job sinned, he was a counselor of Paro, right? And he sinned the sin of omission, and he was being punished for that. And the other two sources we saw say that what you see, either the reward or the punishment, was just to clean off the slate from the little little things, the 5 or 10%, and the real reward or punishment is in the next world, such that what you see in this world is really not what you get, and don't take it to heart so seriously. What happens in this world, it's just a fleeting moment. And there's more. We're still here?
But it's the only moment we have.
It's the only moment we have in this world.
Right.
Midrash Breshit Rabbah. Rabbi Yossi ben Halafta said, Job was born when they went down into Egypt and died when they went up out of Egypt. You will find that in essence his lifespan was 210 years, while Israel spent 210 years in Egypt. So this...
Wait a second. His lifespan was 110 years.
Well, here it says 210.
But in Genesis he was 110.
Job?
Oh, Job or Joseph.
No, we're talking about Job.
Okay, I'm sorry.
So, as opposed to Reish Lakish, who said that Job never existed, but then we said he existed, but these didn't happen, this approach said he really did exist. Now, when Satan came to denounce Israel, God incited him against Job instead. Rabbi Chanina, the son of Acha, and Rabbi Chaman, the son of Rabbi Chanina, in other words, there's a man and his son discussed this. Rabbi Chanina, son of Acha, said it may be compared to a shepherd who stood watching his flocks. Now, the shepherd is God. The flocks are Israel. When a wolf came to attack him, the wolf is the Satan. Whereupon he ordered, throw him a he-goat on which to vent his rage. In other words, we don't want the wolf to attack the whole flock. Give him one of the sheep, and he'll leave the rest of the sheep alone. Let's stop for a minute. So what exactly is Rabbi Chanina saying?
Use a scapegoat.
Right, a scapegoat.
Sometimes you sacrifice one for the benefit of
the whole.
Exactly, sacrifice one for the benefit of the whole.
This sounds very Christological in some ways.
Okay, I think it's also found in the book of Amos.
Right, right.
So, the Satan, according to this, is really not interested in Job. He's interested in attacking the Jewish people.
Mm-hmm.
But God wants to distract him from attacking the Jewish people, so he throws him a scapegoat. Now, let's backtrack a little bit. I don't know if anyone remembers. I don't remember if I've done it in this class, but in other contexts, I've shown that there are verses in the book of Ezekiel, and it's developed in the Midrash, that the Israelites really did not deserve to be redeemed from Egypt. They were idolaters. They were sinners. And the angels really objected and said, the Egyptians are idolaters and the Israelites are idolaters. Why are you killing these and saving these? It doesn't make any sense. And God is hard-pressed to answer the angels. What can he say? Because the angels are right. They really are idolaters. So what God does to fend off the legitimate claims of the Satan is to throw the Satan a bone, to distract him, so God can get the Israelites quickly before Satan comes back.
If this is the case, when people take hostages, if you follow this logic, you're not supposed to redeem the hostage. Whereas in our tradition, we do our very best to redeem all the hostages.
We do, yeah.
So that would be this would be a contradiction.
No, we redeem the hostages.
But according to this, you let one go.
You're right. It does connect to another halakha that's related to hostages. The question is, the Tosefta says if there's a band of goyim that are besieging a Jewish city, and they say, "Give us one of you, and we'll let the rest go," do you give them the one?
You do give them one.
Well, it says actually that
you don't.
If they don't name who they want, you can't decide who to give them, because you'd be killing.
Right.
I'm thinking
so that is similar. Very interesting. I never thought of that connection.
He said, "Take my daughters."
Okay, that's all right. Right, that's similar.
Well, she doesn't count anymore.
Okay. So let's read on a little bit. Okay, we have to go back to the ideas. These are heavy ideas. Rabbi Chama ben Rabbi Chanina, the son of the previous rabbi, said, "It may be compared to a king sitting at his meal when a dog came and attacked him, whereupon he ordered, 'Give him a bone to preoccupy him.' Thus it is written in Job, 'God delivered me to the ungodly and cast this me into the hands of the wicked.'" Now, both of these parables are very similar. Rabbi Chanina and Rabbi Chama, the son. There may be one difference. In the first parable, the wolf is attacking the flock, whereas in the second case, the dog is attacking the king himself. But in both cases, there's a scapegoat given to preoccupy the dog or the wolf. And the last line says, "Would that the people have been righteous, but they are indeed wicked, as the Israelites were wicked, therefore this scapegoat was required."
The bone is from an animal already dead, though, right?
Well, is the implication here that the attack on the king is that Satan was attacking God?
I guess so. Although I don't know really how to parse that. But you could say that any attack against the Jewish people is attack against God, perhaps. Okay, so what do we do with this? So what do we do with this midrash? Certainly, it's coming to tell us that there is rhyme and reason to what happens to Job. But it's not because of his own sins, like the previous midrashim. It's because of the sins of others. Job is actually the salvation of the Jewish people. He's a lightning rod. He's a scapegoat. He suffers for the sins of others. And you said, indeed, that that reminds us of Christological things.
Yeah,
but it's right
Christ.
Here in the Midrash.
You know, it's always Christ died to save us.
So if you look at the Jewish people, not as individuals, but as one collective body, right?
Yeah.
Then you understand that the Jewish people are suffering for their sins. But thank God the disease doesn't consume the whole body, just one of us.
Not thank God. Thank Job.
Well, Job wasn't asked, right? Now, remember that the book of Job says that he was a totally righteous guy. Well, that's exactly the point. That had the Satan gotten into the flock of the Israelites, he would have easily devoured us because we were guilty and the Satan would overcome us. But if God throws to Satan a totally righteous man, then the Satan has to struggle to find a way to overcome, and the Satan will not overcome. In the end, the Satan will waste his time trying to get the better of Job and will fail, and in the meanwhile, the Jewish people will escape.
Why not just get rid of the Satan?
Right. Very good. In other words, there seems to be here, if we take this Midrash literally, there seems to be an assumption here that God has to deal with powers that are independent. The Shatan.
So he's not omnipotent.
So he's not omnipotent, says Stephanie. But do we have to take the Midrash literally?
No.
Perhaps not. Perhaps we could just say that the Jewish people are evil. They were idolaters. And justice demands that they not be taken out of Egypt. How does God manage to take them out of Egypt? How does God manage to do justice? By causing Job to suffer. Now, Job is so righteous that when he suffers, the suffering is so terrible that atones for the whole Jewish people.
It seems to me that what we're really dealing with here is the question of whether you can have suffering without sin.
Right. Okay.
And
that's always the question.
This rabbi is saying, in effect, when you use the example of Job to say that, you know, someplace or another he had a little bitty sin, he's saying, my argument is that it doesn't have anything to do with sin. He was just a scapegoat.
No, it has to do with sin. But the fact is, Job is part of a larger body, and that larger body sinned. So it's the same basic approach, that there's no suffering without sin. But just we're saying the sin doesn't have to be in the individual, rather look at the collective.
So that Job is a scapegoat here, right? So he can still be without sin, but he's being the replacement for Israel's sin.
Right, vicarious atonement.
Well, what about
but still, the overall idea of all these midrashim is there that when Job suffers, this is righteousness and God is punishing sin.
I don't see where it says that. Where does it say, okay, is the wolf a sin, sinful?
The wolf is not sinful, no, but the flock is sinful.
Huh?
But the flock is sinful. This flock deserves to be punished by the wolf. How do I know that? For the very last line. Would that the people have been righteous, but they are indeed wicked.
What about the verses in Deuteronomy and Ezekiel that say a man shall not suffer a sin, die for his father's sins or a father for his sons, but each man for their own sin?
As you very well know, that verse in Ezekiel is contradicted by many other verses.
That's true. It's also in Deuteronomy, though, as well.
But you also know that it's wrote in Deuteronomy. It also says.
How do we reconcile them then?
Okay, that's a different question. That's a different question.
This idea is, of course, very troubling to me because one of the precepts of Judaism is not to sacrifice, not to have human sacrifice. And here is this concept is no better than primitive people that we say are heathens or whatever that take the virgins and drop them into the boiling, into the cauldron, the caldera of a volcano in order to stop it from erupting. And I find that this is very troubling, that this would be a philosophy that they have concluded that it is justifiable to do such a thing, human sacrifice.
Okay. We're dealing here with a troubling topic. Every answer is more or less troubling. All the answers are troubling in some...
Yes.
There's no answer that's not troubling. If there was an answer that wasn't troubling, then we would take that answer and run with it. All the answers are troubling, because the issue itself is troubling. But after having said that, it's not the same thing as the volcano. Because we're not talking about appeasing an irrational God. We're talking about a theory that says that there is here evil that has to be expiated. Right, we're basing ourselves on the fact that the Israelites were idolaters. And it's
like
just to punish them.
The carbon
out. Just wait a second. But what we have to do here is to move from the individual to the collective. And we have to go back to things we talked about in the past about all of the Jewish people understanding themselves and as being as one corporate personality. The minute you say that, then it's really pretty straightforward. Right? Just like it makes perfect sense that if my left hand sins, my right hand could be punished. And it doesn't matter that the sin was with the left hand, but the pain is in my toe. It's part of the same body. So in the same sense, it's okay, it makes sense, it's just, it's legitimate. If the whole Jewish people sin, then only Job is punished. If we assume that we're all part of one corporate body.
And Job's not Jewish.
That's a different approach. According to this approach, I assume he is Jewish.
Oh, okay.
That's a good point.
The 6 million of the Holocaust were dying as a sacrifice for not only the Jewish people, but for the whole world since. You could make that argument according to this.
According to this, you could make that argument.
Yeah.
Again, I'm not here to make any argument. I'm here to make the argument that each approach, in its own terms, makes some sense. Some sense.
But not totally.
Maybe nonsense.
Okay. We have more. Midrash Rabbah, Exodus 21:7. And this is the same approach. I just brought another Midrash so we won't forget this powerful approach. Another Midrash that says the same thing. Another explanation of wherefore crieth thou unto me? That's what God said to Moses when the Israelites standing at the edge of the Red Sea, or the Reed Sea, waiting for something to happen. And God says, why are you crying to me? Jump in and go forward. It is written, hast thou prepared... You know what, let's skip a few lines. We can go right to the important part of it. We're going to read on line 5, 6. Line 6. And line 6 is prefaced by a few words before that line. Rabbi Chama bar Chanina said, so this is the same rabbi we saw earlier, about the dog and the bone and the king. Rabbi Chama bar Chanina said, when Israel departed from Egypt, the angel Samael, that's the Satan, the angel Samael arose to accuse them. Because again, they were idolaters. Why are you being taken out of Egypt? Why is God redeeming you? Rabbi Chama added the following explanation, the name of his father. It can be compared to a shepherd who is leading his sheep across a river. The river, of course, is the Reed Sea that they're crossing. And the sheep, of course, are the Israelites. And the shepherd is God. When a wolf came to attack the sheep, the wolf again is the Satan. What did the shepherd, who knew well how to deal with such emergencies, do? He took a large he-goat, that of course is Job, and threw it to the wolf, saying to himself, let him struggle with this till we cross the river, and then I will return to bring it back. Those last 8 words weren't found in the previous Midrash. I'll return to bring it back. In other words, according to this, God knows that the Satan will struggle mightily with the he-goat, with Job, but in the end, the Satan will not be able to completely overcome the he-goat, and God, in the end, will come back and get the he-goat. Part of the plan is to come back and make Job prosper again. Now, everyone's going to win. It's a win-win situation. The Israelites will get off scot-free, and Job eventually will be saved. In other words, Job has the moral fortitude to struggle and overcome with the Satan, but the Israelites don't. If God was to let Satan attack the Israelites, Satan would win, because they have no merit. But if God presents just one gladiator to the Satan, Job has the moral power to deal with the Satan and to survive. And God will come and save him. So let's finish the Midrash. So when Israel departed from Egypt, the angel Samael arose to accuse them, pleading before God, Lord of the universe, till now they've been worshipping idols, and now thou dividest the sea for them? It's not fair, says the Satan. What did God do? He delivered into his hands Job. You see, I'm skipping the notes. One of the counsels of Pharaoh. So I have no idea why this midrash. Darren, I just want to finish reading the midrash. I have no idea why this midrash adds in that Job was one of the counselors of Paro like the previous midrash, because it doesn't fit here. Here we want to present him
but
as totally.
It's a hint that he wasn't Jewish.
Say it again.
It's a hint.
That's another reason why it doesn't fit, because according to this midrash, he is Jewish. He's part of the body of the Jewish people. So the commentators point out it's not clear why they say counselor of Paro. Let's just skip that for a minute. Of whom it is written, and that man was wholehearted and upright, and said, behold, he is in thy hand. So in other words, God gives Job into the hands of Satan, but for the purpose we've talked about. God reckoned, while he, meaning the Satan, is busily occupied with Job, Israel will go through the sea. Afterwards I will deliver Job. This is why Job said, I was at ease and he broke me asunder. I was at ease in the world, said Job, but he broke me asunder, he hath taken me by the neck and dashed me to pieces. In order to make me the target for his people. Now he's a target for his people, for the good of the Israelites. For it says, quoting from Job again, he hath also set me up for his mark. God delivered me to the ungodly. He hath delivered me into the hands of Satan in order that Israel may not emerge guiltily from the trial. He hath delivered me into his hand. Hence, and casteth me into the hands of the wicked. It was then that God said to Moses, right, back to the Jewish people going across the sea, behold, I have given Job over to Satan. It is for you to speak to the Israelite, to the children of Israel, that they go forward and cross the sea, because the coast is clear that now Satan is occupied by Job. Fascinating stuff. Dorothy?
Well, it bothered me also that it said that he was one of the counselors.
Yes, that doesn't fit into the Midrash.
Yeah. The only thing it says to me is that a Jew would not have been a counselor of Pharaoh. Mm-hmm. Not if the Pharaoh knew he was Jewish.
You're right.
And
you're right.
So maybe what it's saying is that God picked a non-Jew to be the scapegoat.
Well, it's hard to
because
believe.
Because when we were doing the class, there was no proof in the story that Job was Jewish.
That's true. And there's an argument among the rabbis if he was Jewish or not. But I think for this midrash to work, he has to be Jewish. Otherwise, why would he be a defender, a scapegoat for the Jewish people? But again, all of this is small change compared to the overall issue we're talking about here.
Joseph was Jewish.
But the Pharaoh didn't know he was Jewish. In this case, well, he wouldn't have been hiding.
Any further comments on this tremendous idea?
It would be irrational that they take a slave.
Yeah, again, that's not to the main point, what we're doing here. Okay, so again, we're still part and parcel of the story of the approach that there is no suffering without sin. And Job was suffering for sin, just not his own sin, but the sin of the larger body. Say it again?
Job was suffering for Israel's sin.
Yes, for Israel's sin.
In this respect.
Absolutely.
And the korbanot isn't the animal that sacrificed supposed to be a substitute for our sins?
Mm-hmm. To a certain degree. So again, all of these midrashim that we've learned until now are not willing to accept the basic premise of the pshat of the book of Job. Well, the basic premise is that he didn't sin at all, well, and he still suffered.
The difference between animal sacrifices is that the animal gets eaten up at the end, right? Mm-hmm. It dies. Job gets double his reward at the end.
Yeah. Yeah.
He gets plenty. Yeah, the animal has it much worse.
Right.
Yeah, that's right. So, yes.
Though it doesn't make such a dramatic story, logic would say that you take a sinful person and sacrifice him because to save the people, to save the collective, and that way the people get saved, and the wicked person gets his due.
No, it's not so. Because if the sinful person is punished, that only cleans the sinful person's slate. Since the punishment was just, it doesn't spill over to anyone else. It's just the person getting his. But if a righteous person is punished, well, that can't be just for his slate, because his slate doesn't need to be cleaned. So that suffering cleans the other slate.
Just have to
assume that the slates are connected. That's again the idea of the collective, the Jewish people.
The story, because in order for Satan to be enticed to go after Job, Job has to be the absolute perfect specimen.
Yeah.
Okay.
That really becomes his challenge.
And the Satan, according to this approach, does not win.
It can't just be you or me. It's got to be somebody really perfect.
Okay.
So now, the rest of the material I brought on Mishit goes in another direction. Until now, we were going basically in the same direction with lots of different important nuances. But the common denominator was the lack of willingness, the unwillingness to accept the book of Job at face value, and the effort to say, in any case, it must be that there was sin in some sense, on some level. It can't be that the righteous suffer for nothing. But now we're going to see a different approach. And this approach is the approach of Rabbi Yochanan.
Where are we?
We're on the page that says Midrash Rabbah, Genesis 30.
Oh, I see it. I found it on the bottom.
8.
Yeah.
Now, Rabbi Yochanan lived in the land of Israel. He was in Tveria, among other places. In other words, in the north of Israel. We're talking about the first generation of Amoraim, the year 200, 250. We have some records that say that he lived until about 260 or 280, Rabbi Yochanan. And he was the leader of his generation in Eretz Yisrael. And I'll say more about Rabbi Yochanan in 5 minutes when we end. This midrash is on the word was. Haya. And I'm going to skip a few lines at the beginning. We'll read the first line and then we'll skip 3 or 4 lines. Rabbi Yochanan said, every man of whom it is said that he was remained unchanged from beginning to end. His end was like his beginning, whatever that means. And then we're going to skip a little bit. And we're going to read where it says at the end of a line, where the footnote 3 is, he was predestined to lead the whole world to repentance. That's concerning Abraham. Similarly, behold, the man was, that's referring to Adam, it means predestined to die. The serpent was, that means predestined to punishment. Cain was, that means predestined to exile. Job was, that means predestined to suffering. Noah was predestined for a miracle. Moses was predestined to be a redeemer. Mordechai was predestined for redemption. So Rabbi Yochanan takes the approach that such a thing, at least in certain cases, of predestination. Now for our purposes, what predestination means is that things are already set in stone and they happen not because of the merit or because of the demerit of a certain person. They just happen because that's the way God wanted it to happen.
Is it often to gain free choice?
Perhaps it does, but let's not get into free choice now. Now, if you look at the examples given here, we're talking about the first man, Adam. We're talking about the serpent. We're talking about Cain. We're talking about Moses. We're talking about Mordechai. We're talking about Noah. All of these are people who not only are leaders of... I'm sorry. These are people who collective history depends upon them. What happens to Moses, he redeems the Jewish people. Mordechai, right? Large groups of people, a collective flows and webs in history depend upon all these people except for Job. Job is the only one here who's really not, who's an individual as opposed to really part of a collective. So Rabbi Yochanan is saying that there are some waves in history that are predestined to happen and God chooses a certain person for it to happen through them, and it's not because of their merit. And all that Rabbi Yochanan says concerning the collective, but then he says it concerning Job, who's an individual. So we have to ask, why does Rabbi Yochanan say that this individual man, Job, what happened to him had nothing to do with his merit or demerit? He was predestined to suffer. And it looks like Rabbi Yochanan is saying, basically, don't look for any sin. Take the book at face value. It happened, and it's not just. Rabbi Yochanan, let's put it this way, is willing to live with a question and is not willing to give an answer. Perhaps we can say like this, the answers are worse than the question. And then Rabbi Yochanan says, there's no answer. That's the way it was destined to be. Forget it. I can't say anything more. But don't look for sin. Don't look for justification. Don't look for rhyme and reason. That's the way it is. Without explanation. And I guess that we'll have to, next week, continue Rabbi Yochanan's approach. But let me end with the following, which I'll repeat at the beginning of next class. Rabbi Yochanan says the Talmud, his father died after he was conceived. His mother died when he was born. Rabbi Yochanan had 10 children, 7 boys and 3 girls. They all died in Rabbi Yochanan's lifetime. Rabbi Yochanan suffered with scurvy for 3 years. He didn't leave his bed for 3 years. After those 3 years, as an old man, he was cured by a certain doctor in Teveri. He was cured, and he got married again to a much younger woman and had children again and lived out his life happily ever after. And the question is, does that remind you of someone in the Bible?
A guy named Job, right?
A guy named Job. Let's end with that. Mm-hmm.